I'll try to do better.
No, it's good.
You're listening to Please Be Reasonable, where we seek to speak humbly and passionately about things that matter and things that don't.
Hello, hello. Welcome to Please Be Reasonable. I'm your co-host, Sam.
And I'm your co-host, Josh.
Josh. It's good to be with you, man.
It's good to be with you. What's going on?
Nothing, dude. Hanging out in your house late at night. There's roaming musicians in the building. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
You have a way cooler house than me, Josh.
Thanks.
No, I mean...
I agree. Wow. I guess. I don't
Thanks,
know.
I agree. Your house
Wait,
is terrible.
I meant to agree that my house was cool. And I just agreed that... See, compliment, man. Compliments like that, those are dicey. Like,
well,
what do you? Listen, they're like no win... There's no win responses to stuff
You
like
live
that.
In the city... Listeners, I put air quotes around that because Josh is convinced he's not doesn't live in the suburbs, but he totally does. Anyway, you live closer to the city than I do, in a cool multi-story house with column things in it, and smells like a Whole Foods, and you have potted plants.
But your house was in the path of totality, so that's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. Yeah.
Speaking of hanging out in this house, Emily and I. Started watching through the new Cosmos series. And
you agree with me that Neil deGrasse Tyson's a wet blanket.
Well, funny you should say that because so we were watching this episode that was like at the end of one of the discs and the disc like stopped like halfway through the episode and it like had a scratch on it because it's from the library because that's where we get our information.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, like it wouldn't play. And it was like interesting. We like wanted to see what the scientist was going to discover or whatever story he was telling. And so Emily was like, look it up on YouTube. I'm like, it's not going to be on YouTube. Like the algorithms have gotten so good for detecting copyrighted content. And she was like, well, just look. And so I looked. And so I found this episode. And it was the episode. But to get around, like to get sneak past the content filters, they like cropped the image to like half the screen and had this random like animation behind it.
I've seen those before.
And they like altered Neil deGrasse Tyson's voice. So it was.
He was talking like.
No, it was the other direction. He like helium inflated. Let me see if I can play this, a little bit of it. I don't know if it's going to work, but you can't listen to this and tell me that Tyson is not hilarious.
Light has properties unlike anything else in the realm of human existence. Take the speed of light. The basic particle of light, a photon, is born traveling at the speed of light as it emerges from an atom or a molecule. A photon never knows any other speed.
Oh, that's brilliant.
I couldn't stop laughing. It was hilarious.
Well, was the end of the episode good? Was it worth it?
Yeah. Yeah. William Herschel discovered infrared or something. I don't know.
I don't know. It wasn't that memorable. That's awesome, man. So tell me, is this for the website?
Yeah.
So well, tell us more about that. Yeah. Because we had a couple people ask about that between episodes.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have a whole lot to say from what I said last episode about it, but
dang it.
It's, yeah, I'm working on it.
Like, oh, it's really cool, man. I'm working on it, creating new content.
Oh, it's really cool,
you
man.
You guys all check it out.
I'm working on it. You were trying to set me up. Yeah.
That was the bump. The set.
So it's
You're
cool.
Supposed to spike it.
Yeah. Okay. So here we go. Yeah. So it's really cool. I'm working on some content. I'm going to work on a page about aliens to talk about like why secular folks think there's got to be life out there and why a lot of Christians think there's not and how we don't really know. And it's kind of exciting.
And it'll just be a link to our episode on it, right?
Yeah, pretty much. But I'm mostly working on the old Earth creation and evolution pages because there's a lot to say there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, creationexplore.wordpress.com.
That's awesome. So you mentioned aliens. My daughter's favorite kids book right now is called Earth Kids Are Weird, and it is an X-Files children's book with little baby Mulder and Scully having a camp out, and it's actually amazing.
I never watched X-Files. I probably wasn't allowed to.
Wow. You think you're allowed to watch X-Files?
I don't know if I ever tried to. Maybe I just thought it was weird and never
it's so good,
wanted
man.
To.
It holds up.
Know.
You should go back to it. It holds up.
Really?
Yeah. Like, for real, you should library that stuff, man.
Review it for my website.
Oh, awesome. So what are we talking about tonight?
We're talking about evolution.
Again? I thought we already disproved that easily using scripture.
We did, but it was one of our most downloaded episodes, and we both had more to say about it, so.
Yes. Yes. So we're talking about evolution again.
Actually, I'm excited to talk about it because even though I'm still not convinced that you can make it fully compatible with a like traditional view of scripture, I've come across stuff that gets you a lot closer than I ever thought, and it's really fascinating to me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's really cool to look into this stuff. So we're going to dig into some of that, point you guys to some sources, and have some lively discussion. I'm going to try and reconvert Josh to Christianity since he's been spending so much time studying evolution, and it's going to be good.
Yeah.
But before we do that, are you resurrecting something tonight? I heard there's a little resurrection going on.
Is there a dinosaur coming to life?
That's right where I would have played the sound clip if we had the soundboard working. I'll just insert that right there.
Yeah, and cut this part out so nobody knows.
No one will know.
Yeah. A dinosaur.
Is that your remembrance of the sound clip from the movie Jurassic Park?
Yes.
A dinosaur. That's so much better than the actual clip that we use from the movie Jurassic Park.
It's a dinosaur.
Dinosaur fact. Hit me up.
Yeah. So you may have heard there was a fossil discovered a few months back that had like stunning preservation of this armored dinosaur that was found in like this quarry in Canada.
Josh, we read different news aggregators. I'm just going to let you know.
Hey, you sent me that science news about the duck appendages.
I can't believe you just said that on the recording. That's awesome.
They found this armored dinosaur in this quarry in Canada that was like stunningly preserved, and they accidentally crushed like half of it with this the excavation process before they realized it was a dinosaur fossil.
Oh.
But the half that they uncovered, it's like super perfectly preserved. Like it's not even the bones, like the armor on the outside.
Whoa.
And so like they're going to be able to learn a whole bunch of cool stuff from it.
Yeah.
Anyway, the reason I wanted to talk about it, because you have, there's a lot of young earth creationists that are spreading this really excitedly. Like, wow, scientists don't know how to explain how something millions of years old could be preserved so well. So it's evidence of a young earth. I understand that. I think you also have to keep in mind that there's the reason this is such an exciting discovery is that most fossils aren't that well preserved. And so like old earth scientists have to try to figure out how this one was preserved so well. But on the flip side, from the other view, you'd have to explain why all the other fossils weren't preserved so well.
Yeah.
But regardless of your view on all that, I just think it's really exciting that God created the laws of physics such that some fossils could be preserved this way. Because if you think about it, if there were like the world could have been such that no fossils were ever preserved.
Absolutely.
And if that was the case, there's a whole lot of things about God's creation that we wouldn't be able to learn if we could only study animals that were still alive. So I just think preserved fossils are awesome and we can learn so much about the universe from them.
Fossils are just incredibly cool. No matter what you do. I feel like there's a joke in there somewhere about how it was so well preserved because of Canadian healthcare, but I can't come up with it. So I'll just let you imagine there was a funny joke there about universal healthcare. I think it's there.
I think, are you liberal, Sam?
We're going to have to talk online about that, Josh. So we're talking about evolution. So let's jump into this. What specifically, I guess I would ask, like, what specifically do you feel like was left unsaid or needs to be added on to from our previous discussion?
So there's just a couple things that I've come across that I just thought were interesting to discuss. Things that I came across since we did that episode. So first, there's this guy, N.T. Wright. We've talked about a little bit on the show.
Yeah, I thought it was amazing of everything on our evolution episode that we casually mentioned like BioLogos in passing. I was like, you guys should look at this, when it's like, oh really, that's pretty much where you want to go if you want to read like a good thoughtful Christian view on evolution. We probably should have combed that a little more before.
Well, we can comb a little bit now, I guess.
Yeah.
So N.T. Wright is a pretty famous New Testament scholar. He's from the UK, and we talked about one of his books on an earlier podcast, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, he's just kind of a Christian scholar person. He did this talk at a BioLogos conference where he talked about the role of Christ in creation.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to play this clip.
When we say that all things were made in and through and for Jesus the Messiah, this is the Jesus we must be talking about. There is no other. He is the same yesterday and today and forever. And this means that we should at least try to think what it might mean to say that this Jesus and this vision of the kingdom is the lens through which we might understand creation itself. Instead of starting with a great act of creation, however we conceive it, and then fitting Jesus somehow into it, saying he was somehow involved in it, we ought to start with what we know of Jesus' own vision of the kingdom and truth and power, and ask what that might mean about creation itself. The results, I think, are striking. To begin with, if creation comes through the kingdom bringing Jesus, we ought to expect that it would be like a seed growing secretly, that it would involve seed being sown in a prodigal fashion of which a lot went to waste apparently, but other seed producing a great crop. We ought to expect that it would be a strange, slow process which might suddenly reach some kind of harvest. We ought to expect that it would involve some kind of overcoming of chaos. Above all, we ought to expect that it will be a work of utter self-giving love, that the power which made the world, like the power which ultimately rescued the world, would be the power not of brute force, but of radical, outpoured generosity.
Man.
So he's making an argument that that the Bible speaks of Christ as having a central role in creation, which usually when you talk about creation, you're talking about Genesis 1 and 2.
Yeah.
But, you know, John 1 also has a "in the beginning," but it's "in the beginning was the Word," and it's clear that passage that the Word means Jesus.
Yeah.
And everything was made by him. And then Colossians 1 also talks about all things were made through Christ and all things are sustained by him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's saying, you know, instead of picturing creation and then trying to fit Jesus into it somehow, we should think about him being central to the process.
So they start with Jesus instead of injecting him in later.
Yeah, and maybe there's some sense in which God speaking, if Christ is the Word, that somehow Christ is represented through the words of creation. And so, you know, then from that he makes an argument that based on how we see Jesus and the new creation and parables of the kingdom and so forth, that it makes sense that there might be this slow process that would be compatible with deep time thinking. And so I've thought about this, and I wrote, let me just read kind of something that I wrote, maybe for a book or blog post or something, but I haven't published it anywhere. And see what you think about this. So the creative work of Jesus seems to involve both gradual growth and sudden transformation. Jesus raised his friend from the dead with a mere "Lazarus, come forth." There's that theme of the creative word of God. And what could be more sudden than the powerful events of his death and resurrection and their accompaniments of sudden earthquakes, a tearing of the curtain, a rolling away of the stone? But what of Jesus' earthly occupation? There's something striking in the image of Jesus, the master carpenter, going to prepare a place with many rooms, as if he enjoys not just the final result, but the whole process of preparation. When he worked in Nazareth, skillfully carving pieces of wood, or perhaps stone, as the theologians say, was he thinking back to his role carving the Himalayas or the Grand Canyon? As he stood in that pregnant period between the thunderous incarnation and the thunderous resurrection, were these humanly creative acts simultaneously echoes of the original creation and foreshadowings of the new? Could there be parallels between the instantaneous resurrection and the instantaneous Big Bang singularity, each followed by slow creative processes, punctuated by ongoing smaller echoes of supernova explosions and spiritual rebirths, of divine interventions that first bring physical life and then spiritual life? Is our own physical birth an instantaneous emergence from the womb or a gradually fearful and wonderful formation? Is being born again an instantaneous salvation or the pivotal transformation in the continuing gradual work of the Spirit? Is it both? There seems to be something mysterious and beautiful in all of this, and it seems a little dangerous to try to pin it down and fit it inside anything too particular.
I think that's really pretty. I think that's a really beautiful way to think about it. I'm not sure how compelling I find it outside of it being beautiful, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, and this is kind of like my overarching problem with N.T. Wright's work, what I've read of it. I've only read a couple of his books, but it's always very beautiful and very well constructed and well thought. But I always get the sense that Wright's theology is like a little too systematic, meaning like have you ever heard anyone talk about the difference between systematic theology and biblical theology?
Maybe, but you should probably explain it for me and anyone listening.
Yeah. So systematic theology is like when you take the scripture and you zoom in to each individual piece. It's dissection, right? You get each piece down to individual thoughts, and mm-hmm. then you trace where those thoughts or truths show up all over the scripture. And biblical theology is about taking a step back and looking at the overarching picture and the overarching principles. So it's like zooming in and zooming out. And I feel like I've always felt like Wright does a little too much zooming in. And what that does is sometimes you make connections where there aren't connections.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you go, oh, I'm studying this and this is interesting. And it kind of reminds me of that and that's interesting. Mm-hmm. So they must go together. Yeah. And that's my whole thing with like his argument about connecting the new creation to the old creation is it's mm-hmm. like it's really beautiful and it sounds really cool and really interesting. I just don't get the why of it. I don't get why that's actually like compelling that they're connected outside mm-hmm. of it just being pretty. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, humans are good at finding patterns
and
making connections even if they're not there. I feel like it's the sort of thing if you already are convinced of deep time thinking and are looking for a way to make that satisfying with the scripture, then that kind of thing is compelling.
Yeah.
But if you're not, it's not going to convince you
well
to get there, maybe.
So here's what's weird, though, is I feel like I feel like I lean toward the idea of long periods. Probably not. I don't lean toward the idea of evolution. I lean toward the idea of old earth creationism, because in large part because of our study. And so I think in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
Already, I guess. And I still just, I hear that and I'm like, I don't get why that's connected beside it. Like, you know what I mean? It's not, mm-hmm. even though I'm already in that mental space, it just isn't connecting with me, I guess. So, I don't know. I feel like I just stomped on you because it was really cool.
No, that's good. I need feedback like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because like anybody, if you try hard enough, you can go all Rob Bell and make
make
pretty sounding words
about
things, but it's not necessarily meaning like but
it's at the same time like it's a really cool idea to me that's a really cool like thought experiment to think through that, like what parallels Jesus saw in creation from his experience of the original creation and his experience of like building the kingdom. I think that's a really cool thought exercise that makes me empathetic towards Jesus. You know what I mean? Like it brings about thoughts of relational connection with him because I'm envisioning how he felt and how he experienced things. but it doesn't do what I think N.T. Wright hopes it would do in making me go, oh, mm-hmm. wow, yeah, that makes total sense of why he would have done the original creation the same way. It just kind of makes me go, that's cool.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I just think it's interesting.
Yeah, definitely interesting.
Whether or not it's a legitimate thing.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting.
Jordan Peterson?
Yeah, so here's some more just interesting stuff. And you'll probably think this is way out there. But I'll just explain it and see what you think. So Jordan Peterson, he's an interesting guy. We might have mentioned him a little bit randomly on the podcast.
Yeah.
Maybe when we had Andy on. Mm-hmm. Basically, he's this psychologist that has gotten big on YouTube. He has these lectures he's going through right now about what he calls the psychological significance of the Old Testament stories.
Mm-hmm.
So he's coming at the Bible from a non-Christian outsider perspective, thinking the Bible was not assigning any kind of divine inspiration to the Bible, saying it was put together by people over a long period of time. But he has so much respect for the Bible.
Yeah.
Even more so than a lot of maybe more liberal theologians. Almost. Yeah,
going back to kind of my whole idea that we've talked about a couple of times of you should read and listen to thinkers you know you're going to disagree mm-hmm. with. This is a guy, if you're an evangelical Christian, to listen to.
Yeah, and because he finds so much wisdom and insight in the biblical text that he's like almost like he can't believe that it contains what it contains.
Yeah.
So even though he's coming at it from this way outside view, the attitude that he has toward it is just really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so he has this talk in his Old Testament lecture series. I think number 4 is about, it's called Adam and Eve, Evil and Self-Consciousness or something. Where he talks about Adam and Eve in the fall, and he just talks about some interesting stuff. So he sees let me back up. So one of the big issues that Christians have with the idea of human evolution specifically
mm-hmm.
is that it seems to suggest, like, the idea that humans could have evolved from other animals seems to eliminate what makes us special and unique.
Yeah.
The idea we're created in the image of God and we have souls, everything that makes us need a savior, and basically everything about the Bible and about humans that makes us special, it seems to eliminate that.
Yeah.
Like, oh, we're just animals, basically. And there's no, it seems to eliminate the distinction between us and them. And so what's interesting is that starting from a purely natural scientific view, there is something that scientists see as different, that makes humans different from other creatures. And that's mm-hmm. basically consciousness.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a messy, complicated topic. And there's, some people talk about self-consciousness or meta-consciousness. But as I understand it, there's basically a general sense that, as humans, we have a self-awareness about ourselves, about others. We think, we're aware that we think, we're aware of the universe in a way that other creatures aren't.
Yeah.
And that, is all related to our intelligence and how we've been able to basically conquer the earth and starting to a little bit spread out into space.
A little bit.
The ISS, right above the atmosphere. So
we went to the moon. To the moon.
Yeah, we did.
Went to the
moon.
For
sure. It was not fake.
Yeah, totally happened.
And so anyway, there's this idea of consciousness, and scientists still don't totally understand it. You have your secular materialists that maybe think that it's if a brain evolves enough, consciousness just emerges. You have Christians arguing that consciousness is only something that can't emerge on its own. that basically God has to provide it. There's something divine about it. Maybe it connects to the soul somehow.
Interesting.
I think there's a whole chapter in the Grace for a Creator about consciousness and just making arguments that it can't be reduced to pure materialism. But it's at least an open question. It's a complicated thing.
Have you heard Science Mike's thing with like the spectrum of consciousness?
Yeah, with like the rat brain or whatever.
No, he's
the worm brain.
I can't remember. It's like level one, level two, level three. And like the lowest one is just like ability to respond to the environment. And so he uses the example of like a thermostat has level of consciousness. But it's aware when the room reaches different temperatures and stuff.
Yeah. But this feeling, and so, but there's something about like...
That's not what we mean when we use the word consciousness. Yeah, when we say consciousness, what we really mean is like high-level self-awareness, able...
Like, I feel like I have this subjective sense of existence that I'm thinking and responding and thinking about my thinking.
Yeah.
And like, we don't even know if, like, we make computers smart enough if they'll have that kind of consciousness or not, or if they'll just be intelligent performing inputs and outputs.
Can I know that we're bunny trailing right now, but I actually really want to ask you about this.
Yeah.
So when we talk about that idea, because I get like I actually get that like the specialness of humanity is insanely important to religious thought in general, but specifically Christian thought, and that kind of set apartness from the animal or whatever. But have you ever read before where it talks about like basically human brain development and how children work and how they engage and like where their brain's at? And the one thing that always sticks in my mind is talking about how, like, it was something I read somewhere. I read it in a couple different places and parenting things or whatever. But that basically saying your terrible twos toddler is emotionally and mentally the equivalent of a fully grown dog, which we have two dogs. And I totally get it. It actually, like, makes a ton of sense to me. But then I've thought about that before where I'm like, wait a minute. Is that... raising up my dogs to be like, wow, my dogs are so much more emotionally aware and thoughtful than I thought they were? Or is that me lowering my daughter to be like, yeah, you are as dumb as my dog? Because that's weird to think about, right? Because I think of my daughter and I just think, oh yeah, human, like everything that makes a human human. But when I look at my dog, I'm not thinking the same thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I think, and we'll just fall on this rabbit trail for a minute because I wanted to talk about some of this anyway. Like there's some really interesting parallels between the evolutionary idea of life starting out as a single cell and gradually changing and every human being that we know starts out as a single cell.
Ooh, yeah.
But we still say we're fearfully, wonderfully made and it's a miracle. But as Christians, we believe that that single cell is a human being in the image of God with a soul, generally.
Good job adding that generally on there really quick. let me cover my base on that.
Western traditional evangelical. I don't know about the rest of you. I feel like some of the theological questions that an evolutionary view would bring up, there's similar questions at the individual level.
Yeah.
That we don't think about in the same way.
Yeah, that's good.
So maybe we'll get to some of that after I talk about what Peterson talks about.
Wait, no, you never answered my question. Does my dog have a soul? That's what I'm getting at.
I don't think so.
So then does my daughter have a soul?
Yes.
But yes. Why?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And you don't even have to believe in evolution to have that question.
I know.
That's what's so fascinating.
We have a mutual friend who is from, grew up in hyper-conservative, like same Christian subculture we did. And now he lives on the West Coast and is deeply, deeply involved in like animal rights activism and those things. Oh, yeah. And a lot of it centers around this question of him being like, animals basically have this high level of consciousness that we don't want to acknowledge. And That was like that question, like actually had a huge bearing on his life, changed directions for him.
Yeah.
But.
So, let me just kind of run through what Peterson talks about.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I derailed you.
No, this whole conversation is just talking.
Yeah, it's we're just talking, man. Like this is the thing. We're just two buds sitting around a table with some room temperature water, and we're just talking. Just talking about life. This is what people do. This podcast is real life.
We're just fellowshipping together. Doing life.
Yeah. Dude, just doing, you know, man, we just need to get some fellowship and we need to do life together. You know, Josh, I just want to love on you. You know that? I just want to come over there and love on you.
All right. So, okay, so what does Jordan Peterson think about?
Oh, yeah, Jordan Peterson.
About the fall of humanity.
Yeah.
So he sees, he interprets the fall as the moment in human evolution when consciousness emerged.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, consciousness, you have the ability to think. So you would have the notion of free will, an ability to sin, that you wouldn't have without consciousness. If you become conscious, then, okay, well, let me step back first. Say, so in the biblical story of the fall, what are the main consequences of the fall? There's humans realize they're naked.
Mm-hmm.
They realize that, they're told that they will die, or there's something going on about death.
Mm-hmm.
There's a curse involving work.
Mm-hmm.
There's a curse involving pain and childbirth.
Yeah.
Okay.
And snakes lose their legs.
And snakes, so there's something to do with snakes losing their legs. Yeah. So mainly we have nakedness, we have death, we have work, we have pain and childbirth.
Yes.
Okay. And so Peterson looks at the emergence of consciousness and he says, okay, so when you become conscious, you become aware of yourself, you become aware that others are aware of you. So he ties that to nakedness and shame. And a general feeling of vulnerability, an awareness that you are vulnerable.
Yeah.
And feeling naked and wanting to cover yourself and protect yourself. Then also when you become conscious, you have an awareness of death, of your own mortality, that you can die and that you will die. And that we have an awareness of death and of our own death and mortality that other animals don't have. And so he sees becoming conscious as becoming aware of our own death. So in that sense, we become aware of death. Also becoming conscious and feeling vulnerable, you're aware of what can hurt you. And so by extension, you're also aware of what can hurt others. And so you have the ability, consciousness gives you the ability to be evil.
Okay.
To sin, to cause evil to others. So that ties into the notion of knowledge of good and evil. And then he also ties into the curse of work, because now that you are aware of your own death, you have to work to try to prepare yourself. And, you know, if you're a simple animal, just looks for food, gets food, eats food. But now that you can think and you're aware that you can die, you have a need to get more food, or to keep, you know, to work harder to get food in case you don't have food later.
Yeah.
And you never know you know that catastrophes can come, but you never know how bad they will be or when they will come. So you never can be sure you have enough. So there's this discovery and curse that you have to work, and you have to keep working because you don't know if you have enough. And so you have to keep toiling. And so there's this idea that consciousness gives way to the curse of work. And then finally, he ties it also to pain in childbirth, because consciousness is, in at least in the, so we humans have bigger brains than apes.
Heck yes, we do.
And so in an evolutionary view, our consciousness emerged somehow as a result of bigger brains. And so, but the reason there's pain in childbirth is because it hurts to push a human baby brain through the birth canal.
Okay.
And so there's this idea that the emergence of consciousness literally created pain in childbirth. Because
that one's not bigger as heads, as
really.
Ones.
Really? See, I maybe I'm just not setting it up right. I find that really compelling.
Oh, that last one?
Yeah, because you think about it, like just take the biblical story on its own.
Yeah.
Okay. Of all the things that humans could be cursed with, like why pain in childbirth? It just seems kind of random.
I don't think so. That seems like a really fundamentally human experience.
Yeah.
Is like this thing that you're naturally driven to do that's so important, it's so vital mm-hmm. for survival and continuation, is also like the most brutal thing a human can go through, and oftentimes it kills the participants.
Yeah.
That seems like that would be like deeply rooted in a culture's identity and in their history and that mythos. That seems normal to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
I get what you're saying too. That's actually really, it's actually really interesting. It was just funny to me because the other ones are like deeply philosophical and like connecting to this idea of like the basic human experience. And then it's like in childbirth, cause their heads are big.
But no, like, I don't know. I like from a view that like,
yeah.
somehow humans separated from apes
yeah.
and became conscious, that part of the cost of that was pain in childbirth.
Ooh. Yeah. Okay.
Basically, how it's interpreting it.
Yeah. So something I think is interesting here is the overarching theme I see here is the human ability. Like I think what it comes down to is when we're talking about consciousness, what we're really saying is the human ability to imagine things out, to project things out. Like everything that you mentioned there, these like fundamental human experiences that work themselves out in fear of death and control over the environment and interactions with others, they all come back to the human ability to make models and to imagine how other people would react to things, what the future might hold. You know what I mean? It all comes back to that. To me, like that's what I think about is like the difference between me and my dog, right? There's a lot of differences, but when you come down to that fundamental, like what, you know, like what makes me human sort of thing, like, well, so yeah, my dog has emotions and feelings and an attachment and to some level has self-awareness, but my dog doesn't plan for the future. My dog doesn't think about whether or not he's going to hurt my feelings. My dog, you know what I mean? Like yeah. he doesn't think about relationships. He doesn't think about his own death.
Yeah.
He's 100% in the moment and to some extent in the past, right? Like he can remember things, but he's not thinking about the future.
Mm-hmm.
But humans, like, we think a ton about the future.
Yeah.
Spend a huge amount of time thinking about the future and trying to predict it accurately.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I just think it's interesting that you can start with the natural view and come up with all these connections that are in the biblical story.
Yeah,
and
I think that's...
And like you were saying, really maybe it's the kind of thing where if you're looking for something, you can find it. But some of them, they just seem really, really fascinating. Now you
for
have
some reason that seemed what you just described uh-huh. to me like connects on a way deeper level than N.T. Wright's thing for some reason.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, who knows?
Maybe it's probably just the perfect cocktail of my own confirmation biases.
Yeah. Slash the way I'm describing things, well or poorly.
Yeah.
And that's just a thing too for all people thinking about these things. Different things strike people as compelling or not based on existing biases and
yeah.
and the way things are presented and whatever.
Yeah, so really, if you want to be positively influenced by something, you should not be listening to us because we don't present these things in any way that's excellent.
But, okay, so I was saying, I think it's interesting that you can get those connections. Obviously, the main problem from a Christian theological point of view is that totally... reduces any role of God in a command in disobedience.
Yeah.
And it even seems to, like, it's really compelling, I think, the idea that consciousness is what creates the ability to sin.
Okay. Yeah.
And, like, that kind of makes sense to me as like what the knowledge of good and evil is.
Yeah.
Because that's the kind of thing that even in traditional theology, like, it's kind of confusing and hard to explain. People have questions about, like, what is the knowledge of good and evil? And why is that something God didn't want humans to have?
Yeah.
But the Peterson's view almost kind of seems to reverse, like, say that consciousness is what allowed us to sin, rather than the sin of disobeying God is what made us conscious, if that's what the fall is. Like, so I don't know. I'm kind of thinking through some of that stuff still. But I think, I was going somewhere with that.
Well, I think I love that idea of, like, if you think about it, disobedience in and of itself, or even, like, I think in a more fundamental level, mistrust, right? Like the Genesis mm-hmm. story of the fall is a story of mistrust. It's the serpent saying, "Did God really say that?" And Eve going, "I don't know." You know, like, it's kind mm-hmm. of this back and forth. All of that goes back to some extent to what I was saying about modeling, right? Of they have enough consciousness, enough awareness to step back and go, "Well, if I do this, God will feel this way about it. If I do this, he'll feel this way." You know what I mean? Like, the ability to disobey on some level is connected to the ability to, like, process, to process out empathy for the other person and what they think and why they gave that command. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? I mean, obviously, like, a command's still a command. You can just go the whole "because I said so" argument. But I think there's something to that idea of Adam and Eve actually, like, thinking through God's experience of their disobedience, and then them, like, you know what I mean? Just that mm-hmm. whole aspect of it, of them having that awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the whole idea of, is something very, well, never mind. I won't say that. That's dumb.
Okay. what I was going to say was, so, like, the first time I was ever exposed to Christians having evolutionary theology or beliefs mm-hmm. was in our college class, Dr. Meyer's Old Testament.
Which one?
The Old Testament, the general.
Oh, okay.
The general credit.
Yeah.
And he had mentioned something about how he had no problem with evolution and Christianity, oh. and, you know, as a good fundamental believer that knew that that was obviously wrong, I asked him, like, well, I raised my hand and asked, well, if that can be compatible, then where did humans start sinning? Like, when did we start sinning? And he basically said, as I remember, "Well, I don't really know, but I know that I sin. I know that I need a savior."
Yep, that
and
was his thing.
Like, I found that so unsatisfying.
Yeah.
And I still do kind of, and I've seen that in other places online, and, like, some of the BioLogos people, that's kind of the view they take. And then the idea that you could point to consciousness as the moment when humans started sinning, because we couldn't sin before we were conscious of our own existence and our choices and everything. That actually I find a little more compelling, of, like, that you could pinpoint the thing that separates us from animals as the thing that when sin started.
Ooh,
and,
yeah.
And make that connection somehow.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Now, there's...
So what you're saying is, when my dog eats the trash, she's not sinning. There's no sin there.
No.
Well, you just changed the entire theology of my home, Josh.
So then I was thinking, well, maybe you could argue that consciousness has something to do with having a soul.
Yeah.
And then maybe even God gives that to us. But then the problem still remains from an evolutionary view of, say there was some generation, or if you take Adam and Eve to still be literal, two people out of some evolving group or whatever, that God gives them a soul or gives them consciousness, because maybe consciousness can't evolve even if evolution's true. Somehow God gives that to them or gives them a soul. Then you still have the problem that if humans are in the image of God and the next generation, Abel, starts with a soul even when he's a baby, even though he doesn't have that same level of consciousness yet, he would, as he grows, he would be at the level that the Adam's previous ancestors were, that they maxed out in, not ever having a soul, he would already have one before he got to that level. And that's kind of the ultimate challenge of evolutionary theology.
Well, the answer is just obvious, old school, age of accountability. You're good.
Yeah, well, and that's what I'm saying. There's going back to that interesting connection between individual human growth and the story of evolution is you actually can't avoid that question by going back to the traditional view, because you have the same question of at what point in an individual's life do they become responsible for sin? Are they fully conscious? Do they have a soul?
Yeah.
Like, so I don't know. I think that's interesting too.
Yeah.
And yeah.
So here's why I think, going back to our college days, why Dr. Meyer's answer is unsatisfying. And this does connect, is if sin is just an individual broken relationship, if it's just, well, I've sinned and so I've broken relationship, the reason that's unsatisfying is because we live in a cursed world, and the curse is everywhere, and we see the effects of it everywhere, and not every bad thing is the direct result of someone's sinful choice, right? Hurricanes aren't the direct result of someone's sinful choice. Like, that's a thing that happens in our broken and cursed world. And so to think of individual choices of sin as the only expressions of brokenness in the world is unsatisfying, because then you're left in this really weird world where it's like, well, where the heck are twisters coming from then? You know what I mean? And why is that happening? And I think that goes, I think that speaks directly into how we think about this idea of human development and human responsibility for sin, even in children and those things. And this is where I'm about to get a little reformed on you, Josh. And so feel free to push back on this one. But in my mind, like, you can't have a point in time where someone starts to become responsible for their sin. Like, that person has a soul, and that person is part of the broken, sinful world, and they are, their whole life is wholly responsible for their whole sin. That makes sense. I think to put it on the timeline like that is an incorrect understanding of how it works.
There's a couple of passages that people point to say, like, there's a couple of verses that talk about a child not knowing right from wrong, that people point to support.
Yeah, it's just proof text.
Some sort.
Listen. Jesus was reformed, just like me. And he didn't believe in an age of accountability.
Actually, something else I also wanted to bring up, talking about hurricanes and tornadoes.
Yeah.
That's something that old earth creationism even has to deal with.
Yeah.
Because even if you hold to special creation of humans at, you know, after 4 billion years or whatever, hurricanes and tornadoes are part of the natural physical laws.
Yeah.
You know, earthquakes are part of the process God used to create the beautiful mountains for us to look at, you know.
That was actually one of the things I thought about after our last evolution episode.
And so,
old earth episodes.
People say, oh, well, free will, there's evil in the world because of free will. And then people say, well, what about natural disasters? And there was one interesting comment Peterson made, talking about something else, but he said, this was when he was talking about consciousness and free will and how we can hurt each other.
Mm-hmm.
He said, maybe humans are capable of handling cancer and hurricanes and things like that, but what we can't handle is betrayal and deception from someone you love pulling the rug out from under you. And people doing really evil things to each other, that really destroys people and makes them bitter and resentful and vicious and breaks them in a way that natural disasters doesn't.
Yeah.
And you know, that would be something you would have to explore and see how that holds up scientifically or psychologically or whatever. But that's an interesting idea, that human evil is on another level, that maybe our human brains are designed to handle natural disasters in a way. Like, there's not. I'm not saying that's a fully satisfying answer to the question, but I think that's an interesting remark.
Yeah. I don't think it's a satisfying answer to the question, but I think it's definitely interesting to think about. I think what's interesting about it, I think what makes human evil on like a deeper level is because we know that we have we know that we're conscious, right? Like a hurricane is an unconscious thing. It's just a thing that happens. Mm-hmm. But if you stab me in the back, I know that you have enough awareness to know what that does to me and how it feels. And so it's like, oh, come on, man. You know, like it's a deeper level.
Yeah.
Going back to the consciousness thing.
Yeah. Another part of the whole discussion is whether or not the initial creation was perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And the you know, the end time will be going back to that perfection, mm-hmm. or if it was like still a work in progress, that even without the fall, there was still a plan for Jesus to come and bring humans to perfection.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting one. I mean, because at that point, like, you're outside, I mean, from my perspective, like, you're outside the realm of biblical interpretation
really?
At that
I think
point.
So.
And I think you're just kind of doing your best guess on
There's
things.
A book called Peril in Paradise, that's mm-hmm. an old earth creation view, arguing for that sort of thing. I haven't read it yet. But there's verses about, like, Christ being predestined from the foundation of the world or something.
Oh, no. Yeah, like, so that piece, like, yeah, like, that's actually, again, I speak from a very specific theological perspective because that's my training. But, like, from that perspective, yeah, like, the necessity of Christ to accomplish his work and the fact that that was planned regardless, like, that's a really common theme in my experience of theology, that the plan all along was for things to go down the way they did. But when you start asking questions of like, wait, was Eden perfect? Like, and are we restoring it to be like Eden, or was Eden, you know, a precursor and things are going to be better after? It's kind of like, well, I don't know. You're just kind of making it up. You don't really know.
Yeah. Why do you think the original creation had marriage and be fruitful and multiply, but the final heaven, Jesus said there is no marriage?
But he didn't say there wouldn't be sex and
oh, man.
Being fruitful and multiply. He just said we wouldn't be taken and given in marriage. So think about that. Think about that one for a minute.
There's an interpretation I hadn't considered.
Yeah. Why do I think that specifically? Because there weren't enough people yet. In the beginning, and when you get to heaven is only a certain size, you know what I mean? It's like Jesus went to prepare a place and he built it and it's got specs and he doesn't want that to be, you know, too full. There's only so much room at the wedding feast of the Lamb, man. Wow. I can't feel good about saying that out loud.
Yeah, that's kind of harsh.
That's awful thing to say.
I mean, it is a narrow road, right?
Oh man, yeah. And you know, he did only the Lord of the Banquet only send out so many invitations. That's how it goes.
Yeah.
That was brutal. No, yeah. Obviously, Eden is different than the end time because it's a garden versus a city. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and another thing.
Well, also, I don't think the scripture ever says that the creation was perfect. It says it was very good.
Yeah, exactly.
But also, if God is eternal, when he looked out over his creation after it was done and said it's very good, was he seeing it at that moment in time of the completion? Or, as an eternal God, was he seeing all of his creation at once from beginning to end and saying that was very good?
I think you're just speculating, going beyond the text.
Oh, yeah, probably.
Here's another question. I'll just ask you some questions you can give your Reformed answers to or whatever. Stuff that I've been thinking about.
Ask Pastor Sam.
From these, you know, evil, non-Christian evolutionary thoughts. why did presumably the final heaven will have no possibility or temptation of sin. So why did the original garden have that?
Well, because God's plan was for things to break so that they could be fixed. Is that a really dark and twisted answer?
I don't know. I'll have to think about it.
Wait a minute. Real quick. Do you think it'll be impossible to mistrust God in heaven? Because that's the temptation. Is what God said true or not?
Yeah.
Do you think that'll be impossible to do that?
Could there be no more sorrow and also have that?
Like the ability to mistrust?
Yeah.
I don't know. Here's what I'm asking. Will you be fully conscious in heaven? if you can't sin?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Well, and going back to the the parallels between the development of an individual and the evolutionary theory of development, some of the biologos folks see the pre-fall Adam and Eve as some sort of like, they're almost in a childlike state.
Mm-hmm.
And then they become adults when they choose to reject God. And they still, hold to sin and humans rejected God. However, there's, they have different views on how that happened, but there's something childlike about Adam and Eve before the fall, something adult-like about their fall. And even there's even something childlike about the kingdom. We have to become like little children, as Jesus says, but obviously not totally the way we were when we were children.
You know what little children do?
They poop their pants.
Well, yeah, that. So poop your pants and go to heaven. No, they trust.
Yeah.
They take people at their word.
Yeah, so do dogs.
No, they don't.
Okay.
Really quick, though, going back to your question, it's always funny when I'm trying to speak to things. Like, so all my theological training is from a Reformed or from a Baptist perspective. And I think both of those faith traditions oftentimes do a really good job of explaining things in a way that is sensical, in a way that like ties a good bow on things, but is oftentimes emotionally completely unsatisfying. Yeah. So the answer to the question is, well, the garden worked out that way because the whole of the story from creation to fall to covenant to redemption to consummation is God's eternal sovereign will, that the way it worked out is the way he wanted it to work out because he's sovereign and that's his plan, which wraps a neat bow on it and makes sense of the scripture until you could take a step back and go, wait a minute, his plan was for all those people to hate him and rebel and then sin and then die? Seems like an unfortunate plan. But I don't have any other answer for you. So put that in your...
Fair enough.
Roll that one up and smoke it.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Was that the only question you had? Just dropping that kind of bomb on me? You're just like, nah, I'm not going to ask any others.
What do you think the knowledge of good and evil is? Because it's not like the trees were the tree of life and the tree of death, like the tree of sin. It's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which I find the idea of consciousness being a compelling answer to that. It's not theological or biblical necessarily.
Yeah.
So I'd love to get your Reformed thoughts on that.
I don't know if I have Reformed thoughts on that.
Or
I have thoughts
whatever. On
that. I think the knowledge of good and evil is the possibility that God might be lying. The possibility that there is more than one option. Like, if you're talking about it purely from the creation narrative standpoint, Adam and Eve's only interactions with each other and with God. And God tells them, God defines almost the entire world for them. He gives Adam all this freedom to define the world also in naming things. But for the most part, God gives them the place, he gives them the setting, and he gives them the structure, and he gives them the rules, and that's it. They then step into that structure and provide kind of like detail to it, fleshing things out and giving them identity and names. But the overarching, the setting, the structure, the rules, God sets that for them, and that's all they have, and that's all there is. That's all the world is. It's just however God has defined it. And I think the knowledge of good and evil is the idea that it's like, it doesn't have to be that way. There's other ways for that to be.
Okay.
Yeah.
There was something else that I thought was interesting that I saw in a BioLogos post. The question of why did God even give them the option of eating from that tree?
Yeah.
And because some people say, well, he wanted to give them free will. He wanted them to have the choice to love him, or to obey him or not.
Yeah.
And then he responds to that. Something I hadn't thought about was God had already given them commands, be fruitful and multiply, care for the garden or the earth. Like they already had things they could choose to obey or not.
Mm-hmm.
So then why did the tree need to be part of it?
Well, I don't think it did. I think that's just the thing that had doubt cast around it.
Yeah.
Doubt could have been cast around any of the things you said.
That's fair enough.
But I think the whole idea of the free will answer is not necessarily satisfying. I think you have to nuance that with the biblically, if you want to be, again, I get that we have a diverse audience, but I think if you want to be respectful to the text, I think you have to bring it back to the idea of God's glory and humanity having this balance of free will is not just because free will is this awesome thing. It's because like God's ultimate goal and drive is to bring himself glory, and human beings having the ability to choose to engage in love and relationship with him furthers that more than them not having that ability, which is a very reformed answer.
Boom. Boom.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't feel like this is compelling material right now.
Well, fair enough.
What else do we have to say about this besides C.S. Lewis?
Well, we don't have time to get into C.S. Lewis, but I thought if we did for some reason, we could talk about how he believed in evolution and people.
No, we have to mention that.
Yeah, okay. Well, we could do a whole episode about C.S. Lewis, but
We should do a whole episode about C.S. Lewis, but for the purpose of this discussion, we have to mention the fact that C.S. Lewis was all about that evolution.
Oh, yeah. And he had all his theology about human and pain and sin and whatever.
Yeah.
I think it's in the book, The Problem of Pain,
mm-hmm.
which is like one of his sleeper hits.
Yeah.
So maybe that's partially. The fun thing for us in Christian culture is that C.S. Lewis is like right under God and John Milton.
It basically goes Jesus, John Piper, C.S. Lewis.
And he was all evolution, yeah. And the traditional Christian culture is all anti-evolution.
Yeah.
But my theory on that is C.S. Lewis started out as an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
And he became a Christian. So he kind of gets a pass. Like, you know, that was just kind of in his background, you know.
I think the vast majority of people in the evangelical subculture probably aren't aware that C.S. Lewis is an evolutionist.
Yeah. But I mean, like, if you told them that, then they just kind of like, eh, well, you know.
What I think is so interesting is his most famous book,
mm-hmm.
Mere Christianity.
Yeah.
Has a chapter where the entire argument is built on, like, the assumption that evolution is true.
Maybe I haven't got to that. I've been rereading it slowly.
It's part of his, I think it's the last chapter.
Okay.
I think that's why most conservative Christians don't know about it, because they didn't read to the end. They got to, like, chapter 4, and they're like, it's good. I agree with everything.
I mean, I read it when I was, like, 15 or something. I don't remember that, but.
Yeah, dude, are you sure you read the last chapter?
I don't know. I'm going to have to get there now. I think my other theory is that C.S. Lewis is a pawn in the culture war, because mm-hmm. he got the story of Jesus and the Narnia movie into popular culture. Like, Narnia is so, like Christian culture in the media, and, like, that's the thing that the Christian culture war, like, that's the whole big thing. And so, you know, he was so awesome at that that he maybe gets a pass on some of his less orthodox stuff.
You don't watch The Simpsons, do you?
Nope, that's devil show. No,
so they've actually been really awful for the last couple seasons, but their season opener this year.
I didn't actually realize it was still ongoing. New show, new episodes.
Oh yeah, they're mostly terrible. But their season opener this year was it was like a love letter to high fantasy, and so it was like The Simpsons set in like a fantasy world, and so they were doing all these jokes about J.R.R. Tolkien and Game of Thrones and all those different things. But there was one reoccurring bit in the episode that is actually wonderful, where Aslan is in the episode and he wanders from people's house to house, knocking on doors, asking people if he can read to them the line, the witch in the wardrobe. And he's basically a Mormon missionary. But in this fantasy world, he's a giant talking lion who knocks on people's doors, and it's pretty amazing.
Stands at the door and knocks.
Oh. Well, dude, so is there anything else you want to talk about with evolution right now?
No, I don't know.
I feel like this was just kind of, I mean, this is just a callback episode. It was like we did a pretty thorough discussion on evolution and how the biblical arguments kind of for and against that. And this is kind of the addendum of going back and going, hey, there's some stuff we've thought about more and some things we've looked at. We just kind of want to throw those into the discussion. So hopefully if you listen to that episode, then this stuff makes sense to you and is actually beneficial for your thought process. Otherwise, sorry for wasting your time. Is there anything else we need to put in on this?
Probably not.
Okay.
Do we have a thing of the week?
I have a thing of the week this week.
You do?
Yeah. Have you listened to the new album by John Mark McMillan?
No.
Lightning and Mercury?
I heard him play a couple songs on it at Audio Feed.
It's an incredibly pleasant album.
Yeah.
You should all listen to it. He's touring it right now with King's Kaleidoscope.
Yeah.
Which, man, I wish I got to see that show.
Yeah.
John Mark McMillan and King's Kaleidoscope on the same stage. Seems amazing. But, are you a John Mark fan? Have you listened to his other stuff?
I've heard bits and pieces.
Never, like, listened to a whole album?
Yeah. I mean, no.
So he gets pegged into the genre of, like, Christian worship music.
Mm-hmm.
But he's definitely closer to just the idea of kind of that, like, Americana singer-songwriter.
Yeah, I've heard a couple of interviews on Bad Christian where he kind of talks about the tension between him being kind of CCME, but not CCME enough for, like, the pure CCM formula.
I mean, he wrote a song that Crowder picked up back in the day. He wrote How He Loves.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, pretty up there in terms of church world songs. And it seems like each album he's got one or two songs that are, you can kind of tell, like, oh, he wrote that one for Joy FM.
He's talked about how the popularity of that song has allowed him, like, he thinks people were hoping he would recreate that hit, but the popularity of it has actually allowed him to do what he wants to do and not try to recreate that, but be a little more original, even if it's not as popular.
Yeah, but he's such a good songwriter. Very, very vivid imagery, very graphic imagery. He uses a lot of, to be totally honest,
cuss words?
No. He uses a lot of violent imagery to talk about spirituality.
Going Old Testament.
Yeah, not necessarily. I just, like, it seems like he connects a lot of things that seem wild and animalistic and connects those to his understanding of the gospel and spirituality and the person of Christ. And there's something about it that, I mean, there are times when I listen to Johnny Mark and it's just kind of a bummer, and it's like, man, John, I need to go like take a Prozac or something after listening to your album. But there are other times when I listen to him and it's like, that perfectly encapsulates my experience of a broken and cursed world and the need for the gospel right now. There's just something about his writing and his music that fits a need in my soul sometimes, and I am a big fan. You should definitely check out Mercury and Lightning. I'm going to play a clip from one of the songs. This is a song called Wilder Love, which you should check out. The music video for this song is interesting in that it was filmed in portrait instead of landscape, which kind of makes my eye twitch even saying that out loud. But you should YouTube that one on your phone, because it's pointless to YouTube it on your computer. What have we become? Just pedestrians. But yeah, so check out John Mark. Mercury and Lightning is his current album. He's touring that right now, but he's got a lot of stuff out there that's really good. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
No.
Okay. Cool. Well, on that note, I guess I'm gonna go read about C.S. Lewis's views on evolution because I'm a heretic.
And I guess I'm gonna go read.
I thought you were gonna say you're gonna watch The Simpsons, but it's all good.
Oh, I'm gonna go watch The Simpsons because I'm a good. No. I can't.
Let's back that up.
Okay.
Well, on that note, I guess I'm gonna go read about C.S. Lewis's views on evolution because I'm a heretic.
Well, I guess I'm gonna go read Ken Ham's View of the Fall because I'm a good Christian.
The best one would have been like, I'm not going to judge people who watch The Simpsons because I'm a good
person. Yeah, that would have been so good. Can I try it again?
No. Oh, man. That was a rough one.
Yeah.